spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. It is January 1st, 2012. It is time to tune in and get squared. Here we go. I'm so glad you're here. I'm going to fade this music out as we get this show, this year, Happy New Year, on the road. If you want to be part of the program tonight, and I encourage you to do so, you can do it anywhere in North America by calling us at 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. We expect the crowd to be a little light tonight. We're competing against three pro football games out there, although the Broncos lost and the Panthers lost, so who cares about anything else? We know that if Oakland loses, which it looks like they're going to, then the Denver is in the playoffs, and that makes everybody happy. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-6472. 530-413-6472. This is the mighty year of 2012. The headlines are reading, "We hope the Mayans are wrong, but maybe they're not." And I think what you should do is you should make plans to be with me at Chichen Itza at Maya 2012 from December 13th through the 22nd. We'll have you home by Christmas, I promise. But you want to be able to tell your grandkids where you were on December 21st, 2012. There is going to be no place cooler. Me and Greg Braden and about a dozen other top world speakers are going to be there. Plus, in the neighborhood at the same time, Carlos Santana and Sting. Come on, there's no better place to be. This is going to be where all the action is. Join me. Maya 2012. Just go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the orange banner on the right-hand side, and get signed up. Get your reservations in. This will fill up in a hurry because people are going to be coming here from all over the world. And we want to have a lot of people from X Squared Radio there. Tell friends, go to X Squared Radio and sign up. There'll be specials throughout the next few months, but you definitely want to get your name and your deposit in now. There are five major sunspot clusters on the sun right now. We don't call them sunspots anymore because they're too big. These are multi-planet size spots on the sun, and they pulse and they move and they change shape, which is unlike sunspots of history. Sunspot 1389 is ready to burst with M-class flares. A recent coronal mass ejection this year, it did hit Earth, but it was slow velocity, so it was largely dissipated before it hit. Thank goodness. All those electronic gadgets you guys bought for Christmas, we want to make sure they continue working. The solar wind is a medium 362 kilometers per second, and some minor auroras occurred. The proton count is up to about 4.2 protons per cubic centimeter. A little heavy for sunbathing, but we don't expect you to be out in January sunbathing, although we're going to talk about the strange weather we've been having as part of the program tonight. Earth is being mysteriously peppered right now with meteorites from the asteroid Vesta right now. That's right, an asteroid. By the way, you know Vesta is the location of the largest mountain in the solar system. Why Earth gets so many fragments from this mountain is still a mystery. But keep a lookout, because we can always use more meteorites. They're just about as good as gold. Oh, yeah, a large metallic ball fell out of the sky on a remote grassland in Namibia, prompting it baffled authorities to that prompted authorities to contact NASA and the European Space Agency. The hollow ball with a circumference of about 1.1 meters, that's about 43 inches, that's a big ball, was found near a village in the north of the country, some 750 kilometers from the capital, Windhoek, according to police forensics director Paul Ludick. Locals had heard several small explosions a few days beforehand, he said, with a diameter of about... with a diameter of that size, the ball has a rough surface and appears to consist of two halves welded together. It was made of a metal alloy that was known to man, and it weighed 6 kilograms. That's about 13 pounds. That's a pretty hefty ball. It was found 18 meters from its landing spot, a hole 33 centimeters deep, 3.8 meters wide. Several such balls have dropped in southern Africa, Australia, Latin America in the past 20 years, authorities found when they did an internet search. The sphere was discovered mid-November, but authorities first did tests before announcing the find. You know, UFOs, you've got to check them out. Police Deputy Inspector General Vilho Hifindaka concluded the sphere did not pose any danger. It was not an explosive device, but rather hollow. But we have to investigate all this first, he said. Unless someone launched this into low orbit on a helium balloon without a chute, we have no idea how this thing made a sonic boom and landed on the surface without a dent. Also in the news, and really this just came in, blackbirds. You remember a year ago, in fact, exactly a year ago? That's right. New Year's Eve, right prior to 2011, thousands of blackbirds fell out of the sky in Beebe, Arkansas. And here we are, New Year's Eve, that was yesterday, 2011, one day before 2012, and thousands of dead blackbirds rained down on a town in central Arkansas last New Year's Eve after revelers set off fireworks that spooked them from their roost. Now, that's the official story. That's the official story. But it happened in Beebe, Arkansas again. And it happened on the same day in 2011. In 2010, actually, New Year's Eve. Officials blamed it again on fireworks, but they had banned fireworks on New Year's Eve from the prior year. So there were no fireworks. And they don't fall dead on July 4th. In fact, they don't fall dead any other day of the year, except this day, 2 years in a row. Actually, there were some reports I did read somewhere where some blackbirds had fallen dead shortly after Christmas last year. Didn't happen this year, just New Year's Eve. The odds against this happening on the same day, a year apart, in the same town, well, they're calculable, but they're enormous. There is a common cause here. And I invite your calls to help me figure it out. So if we have any listeners in Arkansas, you got any ideas? Or if you think it's HARP, or if you think it's chemtrails, or if you think it's magnetic fields, we've heard it all, we've investigated it all, we've talked about it all right here on X Squared Radio. 888-429-5471 or anywhere else on planet or off planet at 530-413-6472. Now, this next section, we're going to cover something a little controversial. We've been covering it because it's kind of a whodunit, kind of a mystery. And we love talking about mysteries here on X Squared Radio. We don't do ghosts, and we try not to do conspiracy theories, but we will follow facts. And this one is pretty flabbergasting. MF Global, you remember MF Global. A couple of weeks back, we did a report on how Corzine robbed the company of $1.2 billion. And by the time all the accounting is done, rest assured it will be somewhere around $3 billion. But during 2 days of recent congressional hearings into how much as $1.2 billion disappeared from MF Global customer accounts. By the way, this was cash that people had in their accounts. They use it to invest in commodities, sell the commodities, let the money just kind of stay in that account, earn a minimal amount of interest, and then they invest it again. This was cash that MF Global just took out of their accounts and invested in, quote, risky investments and lost it all. But they can't account for it. The chief operating officer of the imploding investment firm responded again and again that he did not know anything about it. Well, this guy is also the financial advisor to the EPA. That's right. The Environmental Protectionist Agency has as their financial advisor the MF Global executive who lost $1.2 billion. That would be John Corzine. Yet, as the House and Senate interrogated Bradley I. Abelow and other top executives at MF Global Holdings Limited, lawmakers did not mention Mr. Abelow's role as a financial advisor for the Environmental Protectionist Agency, which, as of Tuesday, listed him as the chairman of its financial advisory board. Boy, just love when the trail kicks up some doo-doo. Well, that's what happens. Pretty amazing. Even as he finds himself the public face of a bankruptcy and admitted to lawmakers that he had no idea how client funds disappeared, Congress and the administration have voiced no public concern about Mr. Abelow's role advising this $8.6 billion government agency on its finances. Quote, the EPA relying on Wall Street for financial guidance is like the blind leading the blind. I think I have a better way of putting that. The EPA relying on Wall Street for financial guidance is a little like two wolves inviting a lamb to lunch. This is Jeff Roach, president of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, a nonprofit environmental advocacy group based in Washington. Quote, in Abelow, you have a Wall Street executive who just presided over the disappearance of more than $1 billion in investor funds purporting to help them help guide federal infrastructure financing. The EPA did not respond to multiple messages concerning Mr. Abelow's status with the board, though the EPA's website still reports that he is its chairman and notes his job at MF Global. When first questioned about Mr. Abelow's ties to the EPA in early November, just after MF Global declared bankruptcy, EPA officials issued a short statement saying only that he was appointed as chairman of the board on March 10, 2010, and that he is not paid for his position. Oh, pardon me while I laugh. Officials declined to say whether they were reviewing his continued service for the board. An MF Global spokeswoman told the Washington Times shortly after the bankruptcy filing that Mr. Abelow was reviewing all of his outside commitments and obligations. I reckon so. The EPA's Financial Advisory Board was chartered in 1989 to provide advice and analysis to EPA's administrator on paying for the growing costs of environmental protection. Oh yeah, the growing costs of environmental protection to business, not to the agency. The agency is making big time money off of fines and fees to business to comply with, and I know this is going to blow you away because it's just hard to get your arms around, more than 1,200 new regulations every single year. More than 1,200. That's right. More than 1,200 regulations a year. And guess what? Lawmakers don't have a clue what those regulations are. The only time lawmakers, that is to say Congress and Senate, ever hears about what's in those regulations is when you, the people, complain. When you call your congressman, you call your senator, whether you're a business or an individual, and you say, hey, the EPA just did blah, 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 just did this, just stopped me from doing this, just told me I had to pay this, just laid this on me. And I guarantee your congressman will say, what? That doesn't make any sense. But when they haul the EPA in and ask them questions about it, They're prepared because they use court precedents. They use legislation, very carefully crafted legislation. Litigation, not legislation. They use litigation. That is to say, they sue in court. They very carefully pick the cases that they know they can win. They win them in a specific order so that they build precedents and they can lay one regulation upon another regulation upon another regulation, and it becomes a self-justifying house of cards that earns them billions of dollars a year off of American business. It is unclear how Mr. Abelo landed the chairmanship of the EPA financial panel, an unpaid position, he noted in his biography on the MF Global website, which, of course, has since been removed. He has ties to EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson through former New Jersey Governor John Corzine. Each served at different times as the governor's chief of staff. When Mr. Corzine lost his bid for re-election and later joined MF Global, Mr. Abelo followed. During his testimony to the House, Mr. Abelo said his total compensation at MF Global was a guaranteed $3 million a year. He joined the firm in September 2010 as chief operating officer, then was named president in March. At appearances before House and Senate committees, Mr. Abelo expressed sorrow for the company's more than 2,500 employees who are facing unemployment and investors who have been unable to recoup their funds. As the president and chief operating officer of MF Global, I am deeply sorry for the hardship they have all endured, Mr. Abelo told the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry on December 13th. My, my, my. Well, my next story, and by the way, I want to say that I really appreciated the last year on X Squared Radio. You know, this is our seventh year on the BBS Radio Network. We started in September of 2005, and except for a few reruns, have not missed a month since. We've had a few weeks where we've run archives, but we're pretty much here every single Sunday night. It's become quite the fashion to be part of X Squared Radio, and it wouldn't be if it wasn't for you, and I appreciate it. Last year, I changed my format a little bit. For 5 years, every single week, we interviewed some author, some expert in a field. And although that went pretty well, the growth of the program went kind of slowly. And the reason is, according to my listeners and my surveys, they weren't hearing enough of me. They wanted to hear more of my thoughts and my ideas. And believe me, that's tough to do. Tough to come up with three hours of thoughts a week. Some hosts manage to do it every single day, but they have staffs working for them and they gather their stack of stuff and they end up with more than 3 hours of content each day. And they also have a big stack of commercials that they run, and I do not. Why don't I have commercials? The answer is very simple. You pay for the subscriptions. $2.50 if you want a single 30-day subscription, or you can buy an entire year for $20. That's about $1.67 a program a month. That's just cheap. I mean, it's just cheap. But I believe in incrementalism, and I believe these are hard times, and I believe the internet has a different kind of expectation. Yes, some people will pay $60, $70, $80 a year to hear celebrities on the radio. But I think it squeezes out a lot of their audience. Most people cannot afford $60 or $70 or $80 a year to listen to archives. But they can afford $20. They can afford $2.50. And they can just listen until, you know, they drop in 30 days. They can listen to a lot of archives. We have over 1,200 hours of recorded archives at bbsradio.com. And you can also listen to it in stereo at xsquaredradio.com. Now, either way, if you sign up through BBS Radio, I encourage you to sign up through the link that is at xsquaredradio.com. It makes no difference to me either way, because either way, a little bit of that money goes toward keeping the lights on here at X Squared Radio. You know, we have to buy the airtime. And as long as you're willing to pay a few pennies a month to listen, we'll be able to bring you commercial-free and unedited. You get to hear everything. You get to hear all of our technical mistakes. You get to hear unedited thoughts. This is the epitome of free speech right here on X Squared Radio. This is liberty at its best. And I would like to repeat the BBS motto, which is, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not mainstream here on X Squared Radio. Largely, we are. But we offer, I offer, the scientific side of it, the maybe more in-depth investigation into the facts than you're going to hear on a 10-minute radio broadcast or one that's been vetted by a network owner. We don't do that here. We bring it to you just the way it is in the news. I will, at every opportunity, bring you the original audio of that interview so that you can hear for yourself what these people say, unedited. And as long as we're allowed to do that and nobody seeks to clamp down on the internet, we will continue to do that. And there are some pretty strange mysteries going on every single week, and you will hear about them right here in 180 minutes every Sunday night between 5 and 8 p.m. Pacific time. Now, this next section I call World War Green. World War Green. Since the 112th Congress began, that's this one, this Congress. Since the 112th Congress began, House Republicans have talked tough about EPA overregulation. They've held a multitude of hearings. They've passed a number of bills to rein in EPA regulation and regulatory excesses, from the TRAIN Act, imposing cost-benefit analysis on the agency, to the RAINS Act, requiring congressional approval of regulatory actions costing more than $100 million, to votes blocking the EPA from overregulating coal-fired power plants, industrial boilers, and I know, this is going to sound so ridiculous, especially for those who live on or near farms. Farm dust. Now, I know, I can't believe it myself. Farm dust. That's right. I have an associate here in a city in western North Carolina that downtown for more than 100 years has been operating a foundry. A foundry is like a caster of iron. They make billets, they make gears, they make pipe. And the city has grown up around it, quite frankly. The real estate was sort of at the outskirts of the city 100 years ago, but heck, you know, we have sprawl. And so over the last, you know, century, the city has swallowed up this foundry, and so it is still operating its, you know, dirty, messy, smoky process right downtown. So the owners said, you know, it would be a great idea if we could move this foundry, at great expense, by the way, and modernize it, and we'll move it outside of town. We'll move it outside of town, several miles outside of town. So it'll take a long time, maybe another 100 years, for the city to swallow it up again. And so they applied for the permit to do so, but the EPA blocked it because of farm dust. Yeah, even though where they're at, they are more polluting. And where they would move to, they would be able to modernize their stacks, they'd be able to modernize their system, lay it out more value stream mapping, more lean manufacturing, more modern equipment, modern scrubbers. And there would be, I think the difference was something like 50 or 60 parts per million more dust in the air just from them driving equipment around the yard than the farm is, you know, plowing and disking and dragging and harvesting and spraying that they do on a farm. and the EPA turned them down. And so they're still stuck downtown after 2 years of trying because the EPA will not let them clean up their act. That's overregulation. That's pretty dusty. They've even sliced a modest amount off the EPA's operating budget. Well, that doesn't help anything. Even though the taxpayers don't have to pay the EPA's enormous budget for their EPA cops, their EPA auditors, their EPA lawyers, their EPA accountants, they don't have to pay, the taxpayer doesn't have to pay, then they turn around and they charge the businesses. So they get their money either way. So it doesn't do any good to slice a modest amount off the EPA's operating budget. That doesn't slow down at all. But none of these measures have stopped or slowed down the eco-fundamentalist EPA from its campaign to destroy the fossil fuel industry and gain control over the entire American economy. So here we are in the last throes of the first session of the 112th Congress, and House Republicans have little to show except an E. That's right next to F. Yeah, the E is for effort. Yeah, we made an effort. We made an effort to look good on TV. We made an effort to make sure we were reelected. And then behind that, we made an effort on the EPA. My goodness. As Winston Churchill said, sometimes doing your best is not good enough. Sometimes you must do what is required. Fortunately, there is still time. Among other legislation, Congress is looking to pass an appropriations bill this week and then go home for the Christmas recess. A bill must pass, which means the Democrats must vote up or down on the bill, and President Obama must sign or veto it. No passes allowed unless House Republicans allow it. The House GOP has three options. First, they could allow Democrats to get off scot-free by passing an appropriations bill that does nothing but reduce EPA's funding. As the Obama EPA has shrugged off earlier budget cuts, there's no reason to give congressional Democrats a free pass. Next, the House GOP could skirt the issue by doing what it has done in the past to avoid a showdown with Democrats, passing a continuing resolution to fund the federal government for another month or so, kicking the can a little further down the road, thereby putting off the battle until the 2012 election year, which is exactly what they have done. Sometimes procrastination is good political strategy, but not when the American economy is withering on the vine, and not when 90% of the Americans are looking at what Congress is doing. Right now, only 5%, yeah, not 5% of the American people think Congress is doing an excellent job. Beyond hampering economic recovery and growth, the EPA is actually, for the first time in history, threatening electricity reliability. So much so that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the agency responsible for electricity transmission and reliability, is concerned about this. Uh-oh, we have one commission concerned about another agency. This is what happens when a regulatory body is chartered to use the courts to enforce itself. The EPA leadership, under the careful guidance of a militant lawyer president, meticulously chooses cases it can prosecute and win in a specific order. Then it uses the win as a precedent, like the Corps of Engineers crossing a gaping chasm to build a suspension bridge to the other side. Fascism. Whether it is the SS entering banks and museums to seize wealth for the Nazi war machine, or the Environmental Police Agency goose-stepping its way into the American dream, it is the same result. The president personally supports the industries his benefactor wants to succeed and exterminates the ones that do not support the party, like the pernicious pilot of good ship fascism. The fight to rein in the EPA now will be ugly. They're big, they're powerful, and believe it or not, they've got an unbelievable public following. Yes, I'm not kidding, a public following that honestly believes the EPA is protecting the environment. It will most assuredly crowd the headlines and populate presidential propaganda during what promises to be the world's first multi-billion dollar fight for the world's most powerful office. The left-wing media, green groups, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, and Mr. Obama will falsely attack Republicans as picking polluters over asthmatic children. Their New York Times poll ratings will fall, and the public will square off on each side of the sports bar. One side with the green banner of the Bambiites, and the other with the red, white, and blue shirts of Liberty. The Bambiites will recite the party line of ecological disaster, and the Liberty side will sing, "This land is my land." And the battles will stack bodies into walls built like Gettysburgian backstops to urge them on to victory in the names of those chopped down by the enemy. The Bambiites will change and charge in the name of clean air, and the Liberty troops will charge in the name of jobs and energy and freedom. And if the maestro of mayhem conducts his symphony just right, the final battle will be raging as the poll handles are being pulled to put him back in office for another 4 years at least. There is a way out of this. Clean the House. Vote against every incumbent in every race. Every single congressman and one-third of the senators and the president will be fired. The people will have spoken. And if the people have the courage to revolt against the world's most powerful propaganda machine, the new leaders can dissolve the Environmental Police Agency and establish a multi-state agency that will allow non-petroleum sources of energy for transportation to be produced in America. The Petroleum War Party can be defeated without firing a single shot. And that kind of brings me, it's a good segue. I have been out on the street the last couple of weeks. No, not homeless. I mean interviewing people. And I interviewed some Occupy Charlotte people, specifically a spokesman, pretty articulate. And 4 days ago, I met with leaders of the Occupy Charlotte group in NODA. NODA, no, N-O-D-A. It's a section. It means North Davidson, but it's short for NODA. They spoke intelligently about their position. I have to give them that. I'm not saying I agreed or disagreed with them, but they nevertheless did speak intelligently about their position, completing sentences and everything. I invited them to come on tonight's program, gave them my contact information, and they failed to show up. And now, I know why. They may have actually been arrested 2 days ago at their camp in Charlotte. I'm going to play you the audio, just so you know what went on, and then I'm going to fill in the pieces there. So, no big deal. Don't be scared. Everything's under control. Here we go. We're going to be talking.
All new this morning, four people arrested overnight after police say they started a fire in Center City. We have this exclusive video of police cleaning up what was used to start the fire, an American flag. It happened near Trade and Davidson, right in front of the Occupy Charlotte campsite. WDTV's Camman Ron Lee live this morning in front of the old City Hall on Trade Street with a story you'll see only on WDTV. Ron, police say the people arrested this morning were protesters. Do we know if they were actually part of Occupy Charlotte?
Well, that's exactly right, Christine. Well, cops told me that they're not 100% sure if these protesters were involved with the Occupy Charlotte movement, but it certainly happened, as you could see, right in their own backyard. Now, these guys apparently told the cops that they were burning a symbol in protest. That symbol was the American flag. Now, this is a video that you will see exclusively on WBTV News. Now, cops say they spotted the four men lighting something on fire on the grounds where Occupy Charlotte is entrenched. They called firefighters who knocked the flames down. That's when they saw what was on fire. You can see here the charred remains of the stripes and a few surviving stars of the American flag. The Charlotte police quickly slapped the cuffs on four of the protesters. They hit Stephen Morris, Jason Bargert, Michael Beale, and Alex Taylor with being careless with fire, which is a misdemeanor under city ordinances. Now, police tell me that during the arrest, the protesters gave them a verbal tongue lashing, calling them fascists, as well as some very colorful other names. Now, it's not illegal, to be very clear, to burn the American flag. The problem is if you burn it outside of a fire pit or within 10 feet of very flammable tents, like what happened here this morning. On the road, I'm Cam Man, Ron Lee, WBTV, on your side. All right?
All right, so there you go. That is what happened. That's the news. That's the actual news report. The actual report is unclear, but what is clear is that someone burned a flag. Now, it was burned, you know, very close, like within 2 yards of a tent where these individuals were staying. And the individuals that were arrested are the ones that said that the symbol was being burned. And they are the ones that, I'm going to say, verbally resisted arrest. Fortunately, they were taken without having to use force. The ones arrested did not deny they were the ones doing the burning. And I invite anyone out there listening in Charlotte or the surrounding area to weigh in on this. Call me. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. We're after the truth. We want to know what's going on. I listened to many, many interviews, talked to many people. Some people are frustrated with the lack of action by the group that's staying down in Charlotte. They appear to just be camping and enjoying the mild weather. They're not standing out in front of Bank of America. They're not standing out in front of Duke Energy. They're not standing out in front of Wells Fargo, all of whose headquarters are in downtown Charlotte. There are lots of things that could be said, lots of things that could be done. I was really entertained and amused, and I think even in some cases inspired by some of the signs. Hang on. And some of the signs were really, really good. They're taking good advice, and the signs make a lot of sense. They're still not specifically going after certain cabinet members, which I strongly encourage anyone out there to do. Ask for the resignation of the Secretary of Energy, the Secretary of Education, the Secretary of Agriculture. You know, these are areas where literally tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer funds are being laundered back to political parties. That's just not supposed to happen. Anyway, they have my number. I promise you anonymity, not a problem. If you want to reach me here at Skype at X2-Radio, you can do that. People are speaking out about this. They're not all OccuParty members. This is a statement made before the Charlotte City Council a short while back. Stephen Navarro did a great job fitting all his words into the time allotted. I don't know if you've ever spoken before City Council, but they give you a fixed amount of time that you can speak. And if you have a lot to say, you better not stutter. And you better get it all in there. They're going to cut you off in mid-sentence. Stephen did a marvelous job of doing that. And I don't think he would mind if I shared his words with you. I want you to listen carefully to the content, because this is history being written right now. And you're part of it. And if you're not, you should be. So this is Stephen Navarro. He's talking before the City Council in Charlotte.
Stephen Navarro.
He's making his way to the mic.
Oh, Thank you, Mayor Fox and members of City Council for hearing me today. My speech is on Occupy Charlotte and our country's fiscal situation. My goal is to persuade you to stay the course on how you have treated the spontaneous uprising compared to other cities and support them in every way to do so in these protests. 10 years ago today, and during the 9/11 attacks, I was a sergeant in the 3rd Infantry Division in former Yugoslavia protecting Muslims from genocide. Being this spot in history made me very interested in foreign policy, politics, economics, history, philosophy, and warfare. Maybe dedicate my life to others just like all of you here. Please take in what I'm about to say as if I were a citizen meeting at the grocery store who insisted on a minute of your time and trust that I'm sincere, not wanted just to rant on TV. Full disclosure, however, I am a Ron Paul supporter. Our country is broke, Roman Empire style, and big changes worldwide are going to happen in the next few years. TARP in 07 and QE since then just kicked the can on the day of reckoning down the road. Being the issue of the world's reserve currency allowed the federal government to transition us from a peaceful republic to a military empire, and we got cheap goods from abroad. Even though our country's been in decline and been uncompetitive for decades, we have been able to print and borrow to maintain our standard of living. The housing bubble was America's last spending spree. This system is rapidly coming to an end. The unraveling of the worldwide dollar reserve standard is why there are protests in the Middle East, in Greece, and now in our streets. The occupiers are right when they chant, "Banks got bailed out, we got sold out." A lot of people here have disdain for the occupiers because of their apparent flaws. However, the flaws in their protesters simply reflect Americans' youth today. It's not their fault. This is simply the stock of what America's putting out nowadays. Thank No Child Left Behind, our bankrupt culture, and the fact that we lost a work ethic. Despite them not being perfect human beings, the occupiers are better than 85% of people that are home watching football on weekends. The only problem is that they're directing their efforts at Bank of America instead of the Federal Reserve, the great counterfeiter, ironically, right across from 600 East Trade Street. It is a young America who will be stuck with the bills and face the prospects of a standard of living much lower than they once grew up with expecting and that you also have enjoyed. This alone should command all of our respect. It was very naive and disgusting that a federal government to coordinate evictions of occupiers around the country as of ruining some tents and cracking a few skulls and make them give up and go home. Thank you for not participating in this. History will be very kind to you. Different cities will be hit differently when inflation starts getting out of hand. And for all I know, a city like Oakland might get burned to the ground. Imagine if that Iraq veteran would actually die from the gas canister to his head. My opinion, our only hope is that the Tea Party and the Occupy movement find each other, form an unholy alliance between the anti-war far left and the anti-war far right, and force the federal government to end our military empire before we're bankrupt. It's well about time. I call shenanigans on their "we are the 99% nonsense, since they do not even want to start a dialogue with the Tea Party. But if they did, and it happened in Charlotte, we can be the city that restores the republic. Please go down there and talk to them and try to make this happen. Cam out them for tonight. They're not protesting you, after all. And I want to say this costs money and ruined property. What about your frugality when we built NASCAR museums, whitewater centers, and NBA arenas? Even if there's a small chance this can happen here in the Queen City, we facilitate it. If Greece and Greece are already throwing Molotov cocktails at police, Charlotte is a friendly city. Let's keep it that way. I might not agree with what all the occupiers say, but I'll fight for the right to say it. Why? Because I am America, and so can you.
I appreciate you.
All right, so he got cut off right there at the end, but if you missed part of it, I encourage you to listen to the archive, because Stephen Navarro does a great job of getting a lot of information into his allotted time, and he is right. The U.S. is broke. Roman Empire style broke. He's right. The Federal Reserve is the greatest counterfeiter of all time. I've described this as alchemy, and well, it is. Little ones and zeros converted into dollars out of the blackness of space. Talk about zero-point money. That's what we have. Zero-point money being counted and spent by zero-point banks. Even though banks provide no value whatsoever, they get to bleed the community dry while they build billions in new towers and make the taxpayer pay for any losses. During my conversation with the Occuparty, they targeted the banks. They should add the insurance companies as well. It is a protection racket that cannot lose. The odds are calculated down to the Russians invading Florida wearing rubber gum boots. It's been figured out, evaluated, and has had a premium affixed to it. They cannot lose. The profits they make own everything. Everything. The banks, the airlines, the government buildings, the oil, everything. And you cannot refuse to pay them, because the laws are written that you must buy their product, and there is no competition. For every risk, there are fewer than 6 underwriters. Those six are at the headwaters of all cash in the world. I was pleased to see the Occuparty sporting signs. The nicest sign I saw was fashioned in the Bank of America logo with its stylized American flag. The words were clear and in the famous blue font, but they said, "Bend over, America." The only thing missing was the names of the actual people who are at the head of these organizations. When I asked them about why they don't demand the resignation of Secretary Chu, Secretary LaHood, and other Obama appointees who run the agencies like dukes and earls, they said it wouldn't do any good. They would just be replaced with someone worse. Well, I disagree. The solution is political and diplomatic, not violent. Anarchy is not the answer. Overwhelming resistance to the most talented and richest propaganda machine in history is the answer. Freedom and liberty are the answers as outlined in the Constitution. The answer is to elect representatives in the Republic. The entire problem arose because we, the people, stopped paying attention. That is the Occuparty's greatest value. They pay attention. You pay attention. I can tell you this. I think they get it. They now know the same thing that many are saying. After 3 years of this presidency, there is no hope and there is no change. 99% of the people get it. Now, if 99% of the people would show up in Charlotte this year in the millions and vote every single incumbent out of office, we could change the world. It's time they got out of our house. In the next hour, well, I'll see you. We still have some time. We've got 10 minutes in this hour. Do you want to hear what the Get Out of Our House founder, Tim Cox, has to say about a movement that is gaining strength with each passing day? I thought you might. I happen to have an audio link here. It's not much, about 3 minutes worth. This is Tim Cox. He is the writer of Get Out of Our House, and he's the founder of GetOutOfOurHouse.com. Listen to this.
Group has at least one thing in common.
There's no contact. They don't care what we think.
They're fed up, frustrated about how they're being represented in Congress by both Democrats and Republicans.
They get in there. They stay there too long. They make all these bad friends that are crooks as far as I'm concerned.
Tim Cox felt the same way. He took it one step further and wrote a book. Now he hopes to start a movement.
Most people will fire every single member of Congress if given a viable choice, and that's what we're about to do.
That's the basis of the GO movement, spelled G-O-O-O-H. It stands for Get Out of Our House. He wants to do just that by firing all 435 members of the House of Representatives.
They're non-representing representatives. They're politicians. They represent the special interest groups that fund them. They represent their party, and they represent their own political career long before they ever represent you or I.
Cox is asking interested candidates to fill out a survey online that asks 100 questions about where they stand on political issues. Then what they're calling a citizen representative will be chosen based on their position after a series of eliminations. Those chosen will then go up against the more traditional candidates. The difference? The citizen representative pledges not to veer from their positions that got them into office. If the process seems just too simple, Cox says that's the point. The goal is to have a say about who's on the ballot before ever casting a vote. In Charlotte, Andrea Klein-Thomas, News 14, Carolina.
So, there you have it. This Get Out of Our House movement. It's a G-O-O-H, G-O-O-H.com, if you want to go there and fill out the paperwork, learn about Tim Cox, learn about his movement. We have some house cleaning to do. There's no doubt about it. Rip up the rugs, people. We're sweeping the place out. We're sending the world a message that we can clean house without violence. We don't have to take to the streets. We don't have to do what Egypt did. We don't have to go out there and take a beating. You don't have to go out there and literally throw their desks out in the street. We have a process. It is the oldest and most stable constitution in the world. We have a process every 2 years. That's a pretty short time, people. Things can't get too out of hand in 2 years. Pretty smart idea from the founding fathers, with the exception of the Supreme Court. They get to serve for life, but hopefully we appoint people of sound mind and judgment, and they're able to do those jobs for the rest of their meaningful life without changing their policies or veering too far from the Constitution. But elected officials are different. Now, we've sent congressmen and senators to office with a mandate from the people to establish term limits. Of course, they've never been voted in. I mean, come on, when you can go into Congress making $70,000 a year, have your salary raised, I think they're making $160,000 a year now, or $170,000 a year now, and literally in 4 years, you're a multimillionaire. Yeah, now, that's pretty tough to do on $170,000 a year in Washington, when you're talking about an apartment that can hold a small family that costs about $2,000 a month. You don't want to live in a wrong part of town. You want to live pretty close to the Capitol. You have to have a parking place. You've got to pay for transportation. You work incredibly long hours, 7 days a week during the times that you're on the Hill. It is a thankless job. It is called public service for a reason. However, with insider trading and perks and different charities picking up the bill for a lot of your expenses, if you do things the right way and you play ball the right way, you can leave office a multimillionaire. Add to that the fact that you get one of the most premium retirement packages in history. All you have to do is serve one term, and you're pretty much guaranteed $1 million of retirement benefits. That's pretty good for 2 years' work. I'd have to work 20 years at my career and take a certain portion of my income, say 5%, while my employer matches 5% of it, and put it away for 20 years to get $1 million. But members of Congress can do it in just two. So it's a pretty cushy job. However, for some reason, once we send a representative to Congress, he immediately, of course, goes back into campaign mode, only now he can use congressional stationery and compete against anyone who runs against him, which I'm sure people begin mounting a campaign against him within a year of his being in office, especially if he's a member of the wrong party. Then the other party is going to try to put somebody in to run against them in 2 years. So you can't ever let your guard down. But the people stopped watching. We stopped paying attention. And so the political science, which is really a mystery. People have a hard time understanding why Congress does what it does, why the Senate does what it does. It does that because it doesn't represent you. They don't have your best interests at hand because you're not calling them. You're not writing them. You're not going to Washington and watching what they do. And I recommend that people do that. So we have a built-in self-cleaning government. If the people will just push the button, that's all we're asking you to do. Now, we'll take a quick break for about 5 minutes while we listen to some uprising from Muse. But before we do that, I want to make sure that you remember Maya 2012. Put it on your refrigerator. Write it in your checkbook. All you have to do is click the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com. If you go to the website, xsquaredradio.com, look on the right-hand side, you'll see an orange banner. It says Maya 2012. Click on that, and the folks at Power Places, they're one of the most well-respected convention companies in this genre in the world, and they're highly respected in the Yucatan and in Chichen Itza. And we want you to join us. I want you to go with me. I want you to be down there with me and Greg Braden. And we're going to be down there with Sting and with Carlos Santana, who not affiliated with our operation or our event, but they're going to be at the same location. And we're going to be there from the 13th of December to the 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas any other year, I wouldn't ask you to take the 2 weeks prior to Christmas and do this. But I got to tell you, people, this is so important. Your presence there, your involvement there will change your life, and it will change your children's lives with the message that you bring back. You got a chance to help change the planet. Let's not pass it up. Pick up the ball. Maya 2012, the orange banner on the right-hand side, X Squared Radio. We'll be back in about 5 minutes. Don't go away.
Hey!
spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness.
Well, welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. By the way, if you want to get up early tomorrow morning, you can see Venus, Jupiter, and a sliver moon right next to each other. Just after sundown, or I mean just before sunup tomorrow morning. We're glad you're tuning in and getting squared right here at X Squared Radio. We're entering our seventh year here on the BBS Radio Network. If you think you have what it takes to be a talk radio host, I want you to get a hold of me, bagnew at x2-radio.com, bagnew at x2-radio.com, and let me know, and I'll see what I can do. I got friends in high places. We have sponsored quite a few radio programs on X Squared Radio, and we'd be happy to give you a shot at it as well. The internet webcast radio world gets about, probably 500 new programs a month and about 500, call it quits. In that process, somewhere, we have some that manage to stick to it and think that they can carry on. It will take a little bit of money out of your pocket, but it is quite fulfilling, and you might be able to get some sponsorship out there. You might be able to sell your archives, and you might be able to use the BBS Radio affiliate link the way we do. And we encourage you, if you go to xsquaredradio.com, to click on the BBS Radio subscription link on the front page there at the index. Sign up for bbsradio.com archives. You not only get to listen to this program, but over 100 other hosts. So all kinds of information that you can get. If you want to help us keep the lights on here at X Squared Radio directly, of course, you can sign up for our archives. Our sign-up link is right there on the front page. All the content is in stereo, and we do it at least 96 bits, so it's pretty high-quality stuff. And we're glad that you're here. We wouldn't be here if you weren't. So, we are continuing our program tonight. I want to talk this hour about biofuels. We haven't talked a whole lot about biofuels of late because we've been waiting for some progress to be made. And one of those things has just fallen into place. And I mean just this month, last month, December 2011, just a few days ago. The U.S. biofuel industry has long been stymied. We've been held back. We've been discriminated against by the lack of USDA federal crop insurance. That's right. It leaves only the most adventurous farmers willing to plant renewable energy crops. Biofuel sources currently under development include algae, jatropha, and camelina. Of the three, camelina is increasingly emerging as the front runner in attracting initial investment worldwide. The reason is, as a global demand for aviation fuel for passenger flights is now more than 40 billion gallons annually. That's right, 40 billion gallons, that's the demand. Now, unfortunately, right now, what we have to do is go hunt down the oil. We use a variety of techniques from satellites to dynamite. And then once we find the oil, we have the sometimes untasteful and it can be violent process of seizing the oil that's under the ground. Yes, we have to drill to it, but first of all, you got to get the right to set up your rig there. You got to get a road to it. You got to get a pipeline to it. I mean, are you watching the news at all? Do you see how hard it is to get a pipeline built across the U.S.? Can you realize how hard it is to build a pipeline across Iraq, across Afghanistan? I mean, you know, we're facing the same kind of opposition here. So it is a method, a process of hunting and gathering and winning and spending and investing. And it's 10, 12, 15 years before you start seeing oil from that investment. However, biofuel crops, and notice I did not say corn. Notice I did not say food. I said algae, jatropha, and camelina. Now, camelina is kind of like canola, except it's not so much used for human food. There are three advantages of this type of fuel over petroleum-based fuel. First, there is a nearly 300% return on energy investment. That's right. The amount of diesel fuel it takes to run the tractors and the harvesters, the amount of seed you have to buy, all the fertilizer that you have to put on it. Fortunately, camelina, you don't have to water. You don't have to sprinkle it because it operates. It grows in very low water environments, far less than normal crops. And there is a 300% return on energy investment, unlike corn-based ethanol. Now, cellulosic ethanol, that's a little bit different because you're talking about a non-food source. And as long as you're only scooping off the first set of carbons, it's no big deal. If you have to start adding enzymes to it to get that second level of carbons, then it can get quite expensive. It easily adds 50 cents a gallon to it to use the enzymes. Second, there is no need to commit federal troops to seize or protect this resource. And third, when the fuel is burned, it does not harm the environment. It's true. Camelina is currently being grown in 9 U.S. states plus 4 Canadian provinces. Now that they have federal crop insurance, a lot more farmers are going to jump into this business. Now, camelina has a number of advantages over its competitors, including using far less water, thus allowing it to be grown on marginal land, thereby not taking food acreage out of production. Furthermore, camelina has a relatively short growing season, about 80 to 100 days. That's pretty short. Requires no special equipment to harvest. And the silage, that's what's left after the seed, the oil seed is harvested. The silage remaining after processing can be fed to livestock and poultry, with the added side benefit of increasing their omega-3 production. Very healthy tissues that humans can consume. It's good for you. Now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has given camelina production a major shot in the arm by selecting 40 counties in Montana for a pilot program of federally backed camelina crop insurance. I think it's a marvelous idea. National Farmers Union President Tom Buis added, quote, "Renewable energy production is one of the most exciting opportunities in our rural communities. I commend Senator Tester's foresight in introducing this legislation. Public policy can and should encourage innovation and diversification of both our food and fuel supplies," close quote. Among the customers lining up for camelina JP-8 aviation fuel will be the U.S. Armed Forces, which have spent the last 2 years extensively testing camelina's suitability, with the U.S. Air Force earlier this year certifying camelina biofuel for use in its fleet of Globemaster transport aircraft. Given that the new federal crop insurance will undoubtedly boost camelina feedstocks for biofuel refineries, the Pentagon can look to Montana as a major supporter in its efforts to go green. I think it's just a marvelous idea. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens when the USDA comes up against the president's environmental police. In case you didn't know, the Conservation Reserve Program, also known as CRP, controls tens of millions of acres of once premium farmland that is now showcased as a habitat for animals on their own website. I'm not kidding. Here's how the government defines it. This is off their own website. The Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, is a voluntary program for agricultural landowners. Through CRP, you can receive annual rental payments and cost share assistance to establish long-term resource conserving covers on eligible farmland. The Commodity Credit Corporation, CCC, makes annual rental payments based on the agricultural rental value of the land, and it provides cost share assistance for up to 50% of the participants' costs in establishing approved conservation practices. Participants enroll in CRP contracts for 10 to 15 years. Well, I have news for you. There are generations that have been on the CRP program, and once you're in the program, even if the original farmer dies and their children inherit it, or heirs inherit it, or the farm is sold and the new owners step in, that land can never be farmed on again. That's right. The government controls the use of that land. Now, the benefits. CRP protects millions of acres of American topsoil from erosion and is designed to safeguard the nation's natural resources. By reducing water runoff and sedimentation, CRP protects groundwater and helps improve the condition of lakes, rivers, ponds, and streams. Acreage enrolled in the CRP is planted to resource-conserving vegetative covers, making the programs a major contributor to increased wildlife populations in many parts of the country. Uh-huh. Well, I have driven myself in my own vehicle over tens of thousands of CRP acres. That's right. And it is nowhere close to a river, nowhere close to a pond, a stream, or a lake, has never experienced soil erosion, and hasn't been farmed since it was entered into the program when it first began. Here is the reality of the program. This is what we do here. We investigate, we find out, we uncover the mysteries of how this works. And I can tell you, most of the people listening to this program see this whole thing as a mystery. They don't understand it. It is unintelligible. There's a bank at the top of the food chain. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. There's a bank at the top of the food chain. The FSA implements CRP on behalf of the Commodity Credit Corporation. The Commodity Credit Corporation is a government-owned and operated entity that was created to stabilize, support, and protect farm income and prices. CCC also helps maintain balanced and adequate supplies of agricultural commodities and aids in their orderly distribution. CCC was incorporated October 17, 1933, under a Delaware charter with a capitalization of just $3 million. It was initially managed and operated in close affiliation with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which funded its operations. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation spent $1.5 billion in 1932. $1.5 billion in 1932. $1.8 billion in 1933 and $1.8 billion in 1934. Then it dropped to about $350 million a year. On the eve of World War II, that'd be August 31st, 1939, not for us, but for World War II. We didn't enter the war officially until 1941. It greatly expanded to build munitions factories. Dispersing $1.8 billion in 1941, the total loaned or otherwise dispersed by the RFC from 1932 through 1941 was $9.465 billion. That would be equivalent to trillion today. President Roosevelt merged the RFC, that's the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, keyword insurance, which was one of the landmarks of the New Deal. Oscar Cox, a prime author of the Lend-Lease Act, general counsel of the Foreign Economic Administration, joined as well. Lachlan Curry, formerly of the Federal Reserve Board staff, was the deputy administrator to Leo Crowley. Yeah, I did say Federal Reserve Board staff. Now you see the players that have come together. Let me just sum it up for you before we go on. You got the FDIC. You got a Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was spending money to support crop insurance, not crop insurance, but the Commodity Credit Corporation to shore up farmers. All that money was taken and put into weapons. And then it was merged with the Federal Reserve by using their Federal Reserve Board staff. The RFC established 8 new corporations and purchased an existing corporation. The 8 RFC wartime subsidiaries are, now you tell me if this has anything to do with farming, 8 RFC wartime subsidiaries are Metals Reserve Company, Rubber Reserve Company, Defense Plant Corporation, Defense Supplies Corporation, War Damage Corporation, U.S. Commercial Company, Rubber Development Corporation, and the Petroleum Reserve Corporation. These corporations were involved in funding the development of synthetic rubber, construction and operation of a tin smelter, and establishment of Abaca, that's a Manila hemp plantations in Central America. Both natural rubber and abaca used to produce rope products were produced primarily in South Asia, which came under Japanese control. So those parts were dropped. Thus, these programs encouraged the development of alternative sources of supply of these essential materials. Synthetic rubber, which I need to tell you comes from oil, synthetic rubber was not produced in the United States prior to the war, which quickly became the primary use of rubber in the post-war years. Synthetic rubber was made, by the way, from oil. And now you know how the money behind the CRP program is tied to the petroleum industry and the Federal Reserve. By the way, just to make sure the money trail was covered, the RFC, it was abolished as an independent agency by Act of Congress in 1953. And was transferred to the Department of the Treasury to wind up its affairs, effective June 1954. It was totally disbanded in 1957. That is not to say the control has been disbanded. It's just that Congress relinquished control over the program. It is now entirely run by the Federal Reserve, under the direction of a chairman that is appointed by the president. Once a farmer voluntarily decides to get a welfare check instead of a crop sale check, the land is seized forever by a group of private foreign banks. Even if the land is inherited by the next generation or sold to another farmer, crops can never be grown on that land again. Under direction of the President, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vislak, it's another picture that should go on a sign. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vislak has opened the sign-up period for its 25th year to allow farmers to abdicate their sovereignty over their own land in favor of a farm welfare check. If the CRP lands were employed to grow fuel crops, it would not only create tens of thousands of jobs, it would reduce our dependence on petroleum, vastly improving our national security by decentralizing the fuel supply, and it would protect the environment from petroleum poisons laced over atmosphere by jets every day. There is absolutely no downside to this whatsoever. And yet the Federal Reserve government continues to remove American land from meaningful crop production every year. So now you may know the total mystery of why biofuels, fuel grown from the sun renewably every year with no waste products, no waste products. The silage is high protein, high omega-3 feed for livestock. The oil squeezed out of these seeds can be used to make high-grade tested fuel, which would lower our dependency on foreign oil, on petroleum altogether, and it would create tens of thousands of jobs, and it would put this farmland back into use. I think it's a good idea. I think it's something that should make its way to legislation. By the way, thanks, Mark, for the interlude music. I will check it out. You can send me anything you want. X2-radio is my Skype address. So if you want to get on there and send me something, I'd be happy to accept it. You can send me your questions if you're too afraid to come on the air. There's nothing to be afraid of. 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, toll-free anywhere in North America, anywhere on planet or off planet. If you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-6472. This is just nice to be able to inform you, to be able to let you know. When someone says, oh, yeah, farmland CRP, you'll say, oh, yeah, I know all about the CRP now. I know how it first started out as a program to stabilize commodity prices because we were just overproducing and stripping our land and we didn't know how to farm. Now we're much smarter than that. We know how to do all that very well. But, you know, we have farmers that say, you know, it's a lot of expense, it's a lot of risk, it's a lot of work to go out there and farm. And I can lease out this land and I can put this land in the CRP and I can make a check every year. And it's a business decision on their standpoint, on their point of view. But if they could lease out marginal land to grow things like canola or camelina, they could grow fuel and they could sell the seed to a local biofuel plant that can degum that oil, transesterify it, turn it into high-quality fuel that not only does not pollute, it's competitive with petroleum-based fuels. If the refineries are allowed to keep 2% methanol in it, which I think is, or 2% alcohol, which I think is a great idea. Now, there are things, you know, we look at from time to time and it's sort of like the temperature gets turned up and we get used to it, and the temperature gets turned up, we get used to it. In 2009, regular gas was $2.48 a gallon. I think we would do cartwheels in the street today if we had $2.48 a gallon. Now, for regular, which few cars can even run on regular anymore, I think I saw it for $3.14 a gallon is the cheapest I saw it this week. But on average, it's about $3.25 a gallon. Out of that $3.25, you're going to go, if you drive an American car, somewhere around 20 miles for $3.25. Somehow, I don't know how, somehow we've learned to live with it. You didn't get a raise, and many of us did not go back to work. You know, we're still somewhere between 9 and 11%. It depends on where you are in the country, unless you're in North Dakota. I think they're at 4% unemployment if you want to work in the oil fields. But not everybody can afford that gas. I mean, they make it available to themselves because they have to drive. And believe me, they're only doing the stuff they have to drive to. They're either walking, they're riding bicycles, or they're just not going out because they can't afford the fuel. They have to use the fuel to get back and forth to work. And they're driving their cars longer, which hurts the auto industry, it hurts the electric car industry, it hurts every industry that supplies the auto industry because people are holding onto their cars longer and longer. And the government's done some things to try to help. They had the Cash for Clunkers program, which took hundreds of thousands of automobiles off the ground and crushed them and sold the steel to China. But it did take the used cars out of the market, which raised the price of used cars again and kind of stopped the glut of used cars, because the cars that we build now are very good and they last a long time, 20, 25 years. And the average person owns a car maybe 5 years. I'm saying average. I own them a little longer than that, but 5 years is average. So we can get used to the price of fuel where it is right now. But if something happened, and I mean something, fill in the blank, it's a wide set of parentheses, anything from a port labor strike on this continent or another continent, bad weather, shipwrecks, rig fires, conflict, and that's what we're going to talk about this hour. Any of that will destabilize the price of oil. And you know the way the oil companies are. Even though the oil that's been turned into fuel that's at the pumps now was probably pumped 6 months back, if something happened, the fuel prices would go up within an hour. And the oil companies would make the profit. And you know that I'm telling the truth. If you have any other idea you want to support that, you can call me at 888-429-5471 and we can talk about it. But I want to talk to you a little bit about how these tensions are getting and why we have such a compelling case for biofuels. And what it takes to get into biofuels. You know, you're thinking, oh my gosh, you have to have $100 million to build a biofuel plant. You don't. You don't. We built a very nice plant for less than $10 million in Washington State 3 years ago. It works very well. I think $10 million is a skinny budget, but it can be done if the building is donated to the project. And you have a continuous manufacturing process, which if you want to know how that works, just get a hold of me. We'll figure something out. We'll get the design to you. Or if you want to grow algae for biofuels. Now, there are a couple of misnomers in the biofuel industry, and I want to get this straight. If there are engineers out there listening to this program or people that work for engineering companies that are thinking about doing this, take it from somebody that has a lot of experience at this. 50 million gallon biofuel plants don't exist. They can't exist. It won't work. You cannot truck the feedstock to the plant. And then you can't afford to truck the product to the marketplace. Biofuels is a regional market. Okay? I'm going to say less than 20 million, 15 to 16 million gallons a year is a common size that can make it. You need, in order to produce that, you'll need between 3,000 and 4,000 acres of reliable crop to be able to continuously feed that plant with feedstock. That's a lot of land. At least it is out here in the east. Out west, 10,000 acre farms are quite common. But with algae, you're going to need flat property. Now, there are lots of technologies out there using tubes and bags and tanks and all kinds of stuff. It takes a lot of energy. You're going to have to add sugar to your culture to get it to work. If you really want to do third world technology level for a algae farm, and I'm talking not a huge investment except in property, and I'm talking flat property. Not like Bonneville Salt Flats flat, but you can do this on property that's fairly level. Can show you how to do it. It's inexpensive. No, you don't need a laser, you know, road maker to make 1,000-foot-long ponds. It would be nice, but you don't have to have that. I'll show you how to do it and get it perfectly flat. I mean perfectly flat, 1,000 feet long, 8 to 10 inches deep, and show you how to move the algae around and harvest it continuously. You grow algae on that kind of level, and you can make oil from it, and it's very high-quality biofuels. And by the way, the feed generated from that algae is a very high-quality stuff. Not a whole lot of equipment involved in that. It will take some labor, but a lot of countries, India, Nepal, countries that don't have oil, they got lots of land, they got lots of labor. This is a perfect industry for them. Places out west that have a lot of sunshine, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Southern California, those areas are perfect for making algae farms. Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, use some of that flat land to make algae for biofuel. you can set up an algae farm next to a coal-fired power plant, and you can sequester the CO2 from the stacks and the coal-fired power plant in the water, and you can use the CO2 in that water to grow the algae. So you actually make a CO2 neutral fuel, because the coal has burned, making the CO2. You've captured the CO2 in a liquid solution. You've grown the algae in it, which then takes the CO2 single carbon, turns it into a 5 or 6 carbon sugar, which are a fat, which you then take that fat, transesterify it, and you now have biodiesel or jet fuel or kerosene. And when that fuel burns, you get exactly the same amount of CO2 that you got from the coal. So it's completely CO2 neutral. Doesn't add a bit more CO2 to the atmosphere. And it's effective because you can make money on the oil and you can make money on the feedstock. It's an awesome industry. And you're doing something that cleans up the environment and establishes national security. Why do we need national security? Why do we need stabilization in our fuel supply? Come on. Everybody needs that. Every country needs a stable fuel supply. But let's just talk about how shaky this is getting, because it's in the news. The Iranian Navy chief says closing the Straits of Hormuz will be easier than drinking a glass of water. Now, you know, we would never let our Navy chief make any kind of public statement like that, not in this country. No, 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 no. That guy would be giving up his stars or his stripes within 60 minutes. His career would be over. But in Iran, I guess it's okay. Closing off the Gulf to oil tankers will be easier than drinking a glass of water for Iran if the Islamic State deems it necessary, state television reported on Wednesday, ratcheting up fears over the world's most important oil checkpoint. The actual quote is, closing the Strait of Hormuz for Iran's armed forces is really easy. Or, as Iranians say, it will be easier than drinking a glass of water. And that's Habibullah Sayari told Iran's English language press TV. He goes on to say, but right now we don't need to shut it, as we have the Sea of Oman under control, and we can control the transit, said Sayari, who is leading 10 days of exercises in the Strait. Well, you know, Mr. Sayari, it's easy to shoot missiles at seagulls out in the middle of the ocean. It's quite a different thing to shoot missiles at something that's going to shoot back. I think this is a lot of saber rattling, and I wouldn't put a lot of stock in it, but anything like this that's going to cause conflict in that area, I guarantee you is going to have an effect on the price of fuel. Tension has increased between Iran and the West after EU foreign ministers decided 3 weeks ago to tighten sanctions on the world's number 5 crude exporter over what the UN nuclear watchdog says is an attempt to design an atomic bomb, but left open the idea of an embargo on Iranian oil. I should say, for the record, there is no official evidence, even in the intelligence committee, that says that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon. They are developing nuclear power. But for a company that's the 5th largest crude oil exporter to want to join the nuclear age, because they don't have wood to burn, they don't have coal to burn, they have to make electricity. Right now they make it by burning natural gas or, you know, God forbid, burning oil to make electricity. I mean, come on, that's their commodity. Why should they use it? They should sell it. It's worth a lot more sold than it is to make electricity. They can't charge their own people that much for electricity. They want to join the nuclear age, and I guess we don't want them to. Iran, which says it is developing nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, warned on Tuesday it would stop the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz in the Gulf if sanctions were imposed on its crude exports. The announcement over the possible closure of the only access channel for 8 U.S.-aligned Gulf Arab states to foreign markets, including Saudi Arabia, by the way, pushed up international oil prices on Tuesday of last week, although they slipped back on Wednesday in thin trade as the market dismissed it as rhetoric. Well, they could. They could dismiss it as rhetoric, but that doesn't mean that the price won't go up. Believe me, there will be people who will hedge their bets, and then they will force the price of it go up, and they will profit take. The interesting thing is that you know, our Navy has basically made a statement that nothing like that would be able to stand, and that the Iranian Navy would be sunk, you know, in a single afternoon. The threat by Iran to close the Strait of Hormuz supported the oil market yesterday, but the effect is fading today, as it will probably be empty threats, as they cannot stop the flow for a longer period due to the amount of U.S. hardware in the area, said Mr. Jensen, an oil analyst with Global Risk Management. The question is, will the U.S. go to war in the Gulf against soldiers in uniform? You know, I don't know the answer to this question. You cannot deter a scorpion when he's already on your neck. You know, you have to hold very still. There are two choices, and only two. You can commit an imperialist war against a religion with members who will die to the last infant to see you defeated, or you can develop another source of energy that does not rely upon their oil. Ta-da! That just makes so much sense to me. The latter can be accomplished in one of two ways. Drill for more oil in free territory, or grow fuel using renewable resources. Yes, it will be more expensive to buy at the pump at first, but it will not cost lives. When you figure in the cost of the military hardware it takes to secure that oil, it's cheap, much cheaper. And if Congress commits to the development of these resources at a fraction of the defense budget it would take to sink the Iranian Navy and begin a 100-year war against the rest of the world, we would survive while the rest of the planet stands back and watches. In fact, it would be the ultimate act of courage to lead a world away from the suicidal path of Armageddon, fighting over the fruits of Lebanon. The final question is, are we a nation of courage or a nation of fear? 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471 if you'd like to discuss it. It's New Year's Day, 2012. I was going to say infamous, but it may not be infamous. Year 2012. When we wrote our original series, The Ark of Millions of Years, back in 2004, Volume 1 came out. It was heralded as one of the most comprehensive works ever written on the 2012 legacy. Volume 2 and Volume 3 rounded it out. Volume 4 came out last year, making 2,000 pages of what some universities are now using as textbooks on 2012 and all of the ancient civilizations that have been involved in prognosticating, predicting, designing, dreaming about this year. This year, 2012. We've had Jose Arguez on this program, who was one of the very, very first individuals who witnessed the unveiling of Pakal's tomb lid in Piedras Negras and deciphered the message of the Maya about what 2012 held for the world, what it held for the solar system. And it's unfolding. It's unfolding right before our eyes, pretty much just the way that that they predicted. We are seeing an increase in calamities and catastrophes and tsunamis and earthquakes and tornadoes and weird weather and animal deaths and all kinds of high-frequency particles and energies coming into our atmosphere and affecting even our very DNA. We're seeing it all happen. It's occurring around us. We have also learned that our consciousness is integrally tied to the formation of matter, integrally tied to maybe even the function of time itself. We have watched one of the Holy Grails, one of the fundamental things of physics, change in less than a lifetime. That's right. In less than one lifetime, we have watched the rate of atomic decay change. Now, that is really spectacular, that somehow, some place where we are in our galaxy has changed the rate of atomic decay. Now, we have atomic clocks that rely on this. We thought it was immovable. We thought it was unchangeable throughout the universe. Of course, we haven't actually been throughout the universe. We're looking at the universe from our standpoint, from Earth's standpoint. But Earth is in a new place now. The solar system is in a new place, or should I say a recurring place, a place of increased gravitational energy, concentrated, thin band of gravity, high-energy gravity that binds the entire galaxy together. We're passing through it. We're passing through it this year. We have been approaching it since 1985. It is now 2012, 17 years later. I'm sorry, 27 years later. It is now peaking. The solar cycle 24 will peak later on this year. If it goes as crazy and unpredictable as it has so far, we should be in for quite some fireworks. We have instruments in space like we've never had before. We've got more being launched so that we can get an even better look at the sun and what's happening with our solar system. Maybe we'll know. Maybe we'll have some advanced warning. Not much. Not much. Less than a year, I think, but we'll have some warning. But I guess the frustrating thing is that we haven't heeded the warning yet. It has been somehow turned into so much political rhetoric, green scamming, or all of this argument over whether we have global warming going on, whether climate change ever happened. Some of the greatest radio personalities in the world are really excoriating the idea that climate change ever took place. Climate change is not politically correct, but that doesn't change the climate. At the National Arboretum, the white petals of snowdrops, normally an early spring flower, have unfurled. In Maine, Acadia National Park, lakes still have patches of open water instead of being frozen solid. And in Donna Islar's backyard in downtown Atlanta, the apricot tree has started blooming. It's not your imagination. It's not political rhetoric. The unusually mild temperatures across several regions of the country in the past few months are disrupting the natural cycles that define the winter landscape. What began as elevated temperatures at the start of fall in parts of the United States has become dramatically warmer around the Great Lakes and New England, according to Deke Arndt, chief of the Climate Monitoring Branch of the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, National Climatic Data Center. And in the Washington area, the region is on track for its fourth warmest year on record. That's four in a row, along with its seventh warmest December. That, in turn, has created conditions in which plants are blooming earlier and some birds are lingering before moving south. Scott Aker, head of horticulture at the National Arboretum, says, "It's weird, kind of fall blending right into spring. Gee, that sounds like it matches the prophecy, the prediction." The pattern is most pronounced in eastern Montana, northeastern Minnesota, and parts of North Dakota, Arndt said, where December temperatures so far have averaged 10 degrees above normal. But the mild weather extends to other Great Lakes states, along with New England and the Mid-Atlantic, with temperatures this month averaging between 6 and 8 degrees above normal. That's not one. That's not two. That's 6 to 8 degrees above normal. Just 19.6 of the continental United States is covered in snow, according to the latest snow analysis by NOAA, compared with 50.3% this time last year. Of course, last year was a record year for snowfall, but the level is far below normal. Normal? What is normal anyway? Change is normal. The climate has changed. Scientists and those who question dire global warming predictions emphasize that one warm season should not be interpreted as a broader sign of climate change. It's about long-term trends, and 1 year does not make a trend, says Doug Inkley, a senior scientist at National Wildlife Federation. Temperature anomalies happen for many reasons, and Arndt said some of the mild weather stems from a persistent ridge of high pressure that has settled over the eastern third of the country, pumping up south winds in many areas. But he added that the shifts in seasonality now on display are in line with the warming the United States has experienced in recent years. Russia, India, China, and Africa are also seeing the effects of climate change. The swing between coldest and warmest are wildly unpredictable now. The habits of nature are being affected. We've seen consistently in the last couple of decades more consistent warm episodes for the season than cold episodes, Arndt said, adding that the climate wrapper that affects local weather is akin to the connection between parenting and how children behave. There's always local factors to a kid's behavior. Maybe he was stressed out, or didn't get enough sleep, or was hanging out with other kids who don't behave. But when you see a pattern to that, you think, maybe it's parenting. Well, that's kind of a weird analogy, but I see where he's going with it. The decreasing frequency of cold snaps should not lead anyone to conclude that there is dramatic warming across the globe, said Patrick J. Michaels, a senior fellow in environmental studies at Libertarian Cato Institute. Climate change is happening, he said, but not at the magnitude that some suggest. Some researchers have detected warming trends in key habitats, but incomplete historic records make it difficult to measure these changes with precision. Abe Miller Rushing, science coordinator for Acadia National Park, said it's clear that the time the lakes freeze no longer comports with conventional wisdom. They typically freeze by January 1st, he said. They're not even close to freezing up now. Miller Rushing collaborated with Boston University biological professor Richard Primack to examine how the seasonality of plants and animals in Concord, Massachusetts has shifted since the 1850s when naturalist Henry David Thoreau recorded their spring patterns with precision. They found that plants, including the high bush blueberry, are blooming an average of 10 days earlier because of warmer temperatures. Now that is a pretty good perspective from 1850 to now. Primack said it's easy to detect these changes in the spring compared with the fall when a combination of temperature, precipitation, wind velocities, and day length governs plant behavior. There's a climate change signal, but it's much, much more complicated in the winter than it is the spring. Still, Primack added, New England lost almost its entire fall foliage this year because there were few freezing temperatures in September and October, and more rain than usual. By fall foliage, we mean the beautiful reds and yellows and oranges that you see in the fall colors. Rather than having the leaves turn, they just stayed green until late October. And in a matter of days, all the trees went from having green leaves to having no leaves, no fall colors. While many have welcomed the balmy temperatures, they pose potential threats to both habitat and humans. And don't forget, they also pose a threat to the revenues of the power companies. They rely on heating oil usage. They rely on increased electricity usage for heat. They rely on these increased utility revenues in order to make their revenue models. And when the weather stays balmy like this in the winter and doesn't really warm up in the summer, they lose money. And in the Plains region, changes in vegetation pose a fire threat and can intensify allergies. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is requiring a permit to burn vegetation or trash in light of the state's dry conditions. We have been showing these very clear changes in the biota, the living world, said Jake Weltzen, an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, who tracks shifts in timing among plants and animals. Weltzen, who teams up scientists with citizens to chronicle observational changes about plants and animals, seasonal rhythms as executive director of the USA National Phenology Network, just started collecting data on plants in 2009 and animals last year. Not enough time to view trends, guys. You had to start this back when we were talking about global warming in 92, 93. We just don't have observations of these patterns on a national scale, he said. The recent mild weather may have been affecting some birds' migration patterns, according to experts, but not to a significant extent. Michael Parr, vice president of the American Bird Conservancy, said that while some waterfowl species appear to be migrating more slowly, many birds have moved south for the winter. They would have known. They wouldn't have known there was a nice warm snap in D.C. because they would have already gone, Parr said. So the climate change is happening around us. However, we have reached a point in our economics where war is a necessary tool for success. We are still the hunter-gatherers, now punching holes deeper and deeper into our planet for that black elixir that has become the cheapest source of energy since wood. Remember when everyone burned wood or coal for heat? No? Well, it was terrible. No one wore colors because the soot of the city would destroy any cloth that wasn't black already. Even the water smelled of smoke. Some of you listening have never smelled clothes in the closet with that smoky pine or oak embedded into the fabric. Oil is at least 7% used, 70% used for transportation. In some cases, it's 75%. Because it's cheap. Even at today's prices, 20 cents worth of oil will carry six people more than a mile. If you went to a rickshaw driver in the poorest Chinese town and asked him to pedal you and five of your friends a mile for 20 cents, he would laugh at you. But it is stupid. Oil will run out. It will run out. All you have to do is visit the towns and villages where the wells have been pumped dry to see it. Southern California was once covered in deep wells. Seal Beach, Huntington Beach, Signal Hill, and thousands upon thousands of spots around Los Angeles, Houston, Pittsburgh, Oklahoma City, Nashville were once covered with oil rigs. Now there is nothing but houses and grass or old rusty pumps laying in the field. It's the same wherever you go. Even Saudi Arabia has been unable to meet its quotas for more than 10 years. That's right. 10 years it's been since Saudi Arabia could meet its oil quotas. They make excuses. You know, they kind of hold it down. They make their press releases here and there, why they haven't met quotas here, why they haven't met quotas there. And they publicize that they've even made the quotas, but the records say no. Iran is working hard and against every national will to develop nuclear energy so they can get themselves off of using their oil for growth. They want to sell their oil, not burn it for their own future. Some still say they are working toward a nuclear bomb, but there's still no evidence this is true. The folks down at Wars R Us are using the old weapons of mass destruction ploy again. Becoming nuclear capable does not mean that you will use a nuclear weapon against someone. I mean, come on, who would be insane enough to actually use a nuclear weapon against anyone? Oh yeah, that would be us. Even India, Pakistan, China, North Korea have not used such a weapon. Ever. In case you have lost count, there have been far more nukes decommissioned and turned back into fuel than have been developed in the last 30 years. There is an entire city in Tennessee that does nothing but receive weapons-grade plutonium and turn it back into reactor fuel. Is it perfect? No. But if the containments are built in the right place and not blown apart by special weapons, they will last for 100 years without a single problem and light up millions of homes at affordable prices in a clean and safe manner. The point is that oil used for transportation should be replaced with clean and safe electricity. Not everybody agrees with this. Neil Cavuto says that electric vehicles have never even sparked the market. Well, Will, let's talk about this next hour, because I want to talk about what's being done, what kind of innovations are out there, what is the technology that is the national will, what is seething just below the level of productivity in this country, and what are we about to see happen. It's a mystery. We're going to talk about it in the next hour. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this.
Knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver sea to a new home in the sun.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
That was after the Gold Rush. The Alice Band, if you want to know who that was. Welcome back to X Squared Radio Final Hour, January 1st, 2012. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. If you want to get up early in the morning, you can look at to the west. You should be able to see Venus and Jupiter next to the moon. It should be really cool. We're glad you're with us tonight, tuning in and getting squared here at X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. So not everybody is excited about the technology that's coming. Some people, and I'm sure you've seen the commercials on TV and heard them on the radio and even see them at the top of Drudge Report when you go. This supposed gentleman that has, made all of these predictions about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and how you should, watch his free film. How many of you have watched that? Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, a whole bunch of people have tried to make their way through this film and realized, hey, wait a minute, this is an advertisement for investing in oil and gold. Yeah, I just want your thoughts on it. 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. 530-413-6472, anywhere else on planet or off planet. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us. So not everyone is excited about it, and I've been trying to figure out why. It's a mystery because, if I was an investor and I was looking for a company to invest in, do you think that I would really put my money in General Motors? You think I put my money in Chrysler? You think I put my money in GE, Disney? I don't think so. I think if I'm an investor, I'm going to be looking for a company that I can really make a difference. And I can also see a great return on my investment. I don't really know what GM stock is going to do. It's kind of, one of those mysterious things that is manipulated by market makers. And I really think that small independent companies that are going to make a breakthrough, something disruptive, something that's going to rip it up for a few years, that's or get bought out or buy other companies out. That's where, the real power in investment comes from. And yet, when I listen to investment experts, and I don't mean a broker, I don't mean a financial analyst, I'm talking about somebody that's in the media that talks about investment. And one of the most respected names in that arena is Neil Cavuto. Now, yes, he's on Fox News, but come on, they are the most popular channel out there, and I just want you to hear what he has to say about it. It's powerful stuff, but it's powerful in a very weird way because he has, almost 100% of the time come out against electric vehicles, specifically the Chevy Volt. And I gotta tell you, if it's not the Five, which is another outfit on there, or CNN, or MSNBC, or Huffington, it's Cavuto. So I'm going to play Cavuto's little piece here, and I want you to kind of get a flavor for the resistance that's in not the investment, but in the investment advice industry. Just listen to what Neil has to say about this. It's pretty interesting.
It's not just me. It is now official. The Volt is a dolt. You hearing me, all you bloggers? It stinks. The car you have to plug in ain't exactly selling out. Not even close. Get this. For all of last month, 1,139 cars. That is 1,139 cars. Compare that to Toyota, which sold more than 23,000 Camrys in the same month. 1,139 to 23,000.
Okay, before I let him get away with that, I must tell you that the Camry has been in production for over 20 years. It is a well-seasoned car. It is a mid-scale priced car. It's in a different price category altogether from the Volt. Okay? A Camry costs about $9,000 to produce. That's what Toyota spends to build it. No, you can't buy it for that. But it's a, it's a $24,000 to $28,000 car. Is it a nice car? Yes. Is it a top-performing car? Yes. Is it reliable? Does it have high resale value? Yes. Did it start out that way? No, it struggled along with all other cars. The Altima, the Maxima, they all struggled for market share, and they made their way. So I think it's a little unfair to take a car that's been in production less than a year, less than a model year, and compare it with one of the most successful midsize cars in automotive history. Not fair, Neil. Not a fair comparison. Let's continue with this.
Now news from GM that the Volt could be in for yet another jolt. The company CEO promising today to buy back Volts from customers worried about reported battery fires. To a disgusted former GM bondholder, Mark Modica. Mark, what do you make of this?
Well, I've moved on from being disgusted bondholder to being a disgusted taxpayer, because it's a taxpayer that's getting hosed. I mean, the Volt, the demand really isn't there. They've tried to play this off that this was a supply issue, but we now have over 4,000 Volts in inventory at dealerships, and the common guy isn't buying a car that's over $40,000 for what it's offered. It's a few wealthy people out there that are buying them. And besides the billions of dollars spent from taxpayers to produce the car and the batteries, these wealthy buyers are getting $7,500 each for buying the cars.
And the thank you for that is they're getting blown up. I'm kidding. They're not getting blown up. But I just got to, at what point does GM realize, all right, this plug-in ain't cutting it?
I've been wondering that for quite some time. I guess it depends when auto journalist and maybe some congressional members say, what are we doing?
No, they love it. You know, Mark, you and I talk about this, but they love it. It's like you just don't give up on that love. You know, you just don't give up on it. And they're just not going to give up.
I don't know why. I don't know why, really.
All right. Now,
you know, the proof is there.
Right. But is the plug-in thing what's the problem? Or are there other plug-ins that are doing better? The Leaf, the Nissan Leaf, that's a plug-in, right? Isn't that doing okay?
No, the technology isn't there yet to offer these vehicles in a free market where a company can make profit offering them. Over $40,000 for a small car that goes 30, 35 miles on a charge.
Okay, I got to stop him right there, because that's not true. Leaf advertises 100 miles on a charge. The actual performance is about 75 to 80 miles on a charge. That's not 30 miles on a charge. Okay, he's talking about 1992 technology, 30 miles on a charge. The technology for electric vehicles now, minimum is 50 miles. And like for the Transit Connect electric, it's about 50 miles on a charge. But it does charge up pretty fast, less than 90 minutes. Other vehicles, and I can't mention any specific names that I'm involved with, but they'll go 100 or more miles on a single charge and have some disruptive technology involved with that to help recharge the batteries besides plugging them in. So this is just not true. And by the way, this was just recorded on Fox News not long ago. So I just want to keep you straight. I'm just trying to keep you guys honest. Let's do the rest of this interview.
Then gets about 30 miles per gallon on premium fuel. The value's not there. Yeah. The people buying these seem to like them, but that's fine. There's no reason for taxpayers to be dishing up $7,500 per vehicle. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
So you think if they got rid of that $7,500, tax credit, they wouldn't be selling any of them?
Well, they claim there's such high demand. If they're telling the truth, let's take the $7,500 away. These people that love the cars will still buy them. The common guy's not going to buy them. And the big problem here, Neil, is there's no great benefit. I have a piece out there on a National Legal and Policy Center that discusses if Obama reaches his EV goal of 1 million units on the road 4 years from now, if you do the math on the oil consumption, we would reduce oil consumption by 0.15% in 4 years. And this is coming from an administration that didn't want to drill for oil because it would take years to get the oil out of the ground. We're going to go years and spend billions and billions of taxpayer dollars for zero benefit. And the environmental impact of these lithium-ion batteries is just coming to light.
All right, Mark, thank you very much. And, of course, now the added indignity, the cars will kill you.
Well, there you go. That's just sensationalism. from start to finish. Now, this is what the investment advice community is putting out on the airwaves, and this is recent stuff. Now, the industry is just starting. Like you, I've not been happy about GM taking all the grant and loan money, and for the life of me, I can't figure out how the Chevy qualifies for a $7,500 rebate when it's supposed to be only for manufacturers who make less than 100,000 vehicles. I wish the grant funds would have worked the way lawmakers designed them, but they don't. They are used as a rewards package for Obama contributors. I'm sorry, but you can't argue with the facts. 80% of grant funds went to recipients that are large Obama campaign contributors. That's just the truth of it. All but one Dodge dealership forcibly closed by Obama's car czar during Chrysler's bankruptcy were Republican contributors. That's right. There were almost 7,000 Dodge dealerships forcibly closed by Obama's car czar, and all but one. Oh, and the one Obama contributor that was closed in Denver, he had a competitor with an even larger Obama contribution in Denver. So he was closed instead. The point that I'm trying to make here is that there is a concentrated effort to stop the introduction of electric vehicles to the American highway. It's not just technology driven, okay? There are technological hurdles. Nobody can get by that. We have refined the technology to the point where it's affordable. No, it doesn't have to cost $47,000. It's way less than that. The technology is coming. I'll put it this way. The technology is to the point now where they're practical and affordable. But the investment community is not behind it. And that's, well, I don't know if the investment community is not behind it, but the investment analysis, like you just heard on Cavuto's national leading program, is evidence that they're not supporting it. There's only one way to stop it, and you hold the key. Yes, you, the listener, the public. If you want oil consumption for transportation to be reduced, and I completely disagree with 0.15% being reduced by a million vehicles on the road, that's just not true. If the U.S. Post Office put 18,000 electric vehicles on the road, they would save almost $6 million a month on fuel. That's right. Their vehicles right now only get 9 miles per gallon because they're all driven short distances. They're never allowed to warm up. They're all low-speed driving. Very, very little highway driving for these postal vehicles. That's all stop-and-go driving, the very worst kind of driving that you can do with a vehicle if it's gasoline-powered. It's the very best kind of driving for an electric vehicle. So you go from making 9 miles per gallon to going to making 300 miles on the same price of a gallon of gas, and you have an economic model that makes complete sense. When you have a small town of, 30,000 people that has a fuel bill of $12,000 to $15,000 a month, they could cut that in half. It means they don't have to raise taxes. It means instant relief for the taxpayers. When you have 500 military installations in and around the United States, and they're driving some 100 to 150,000 vehicles on those installations, and you can take half of those vehicles and turn them into electric. No, that's not a million vehicles, but 50,000 vehicles switched from all gasoline to all electric cuts the fuel bill in half. Do you know what the Department of Defense spends on fuel? I do. $4 billion a year. $4 billion a year on fuel. It would make a significant decrease in that amount of fuel. And we're not talking about 0.15%. We're talking about 20%, 25%. That is significant. The point that I'm trying to make is that there is a way to do this that doesn't have to use grant money, doesn't have to use, you don't have to sell off the company to start the company. if you want it to be reduced, you must make investments in the small independent electric car makers. That's all. Donate money to the small car makers. Buy stock in the small car makers. Make it a monthly thing that you will do. Send in $10 a month to see electric vehicles come forth. Obviously, sending $10 a month to GM is not going to get you anything. But $10 a month sent to one of these independent electric car companies or electric truck companies make a huge difference. Be a part of history and make it happen. Yes, it's a tax, but it's voluntary. And if you and you get to choose exactly where your money goes. It won't be the government choosing it. It won't get spent on Wars R Us. It won't get spent in Egypt or Malaysia or Brazil. It will get spent right here to hire Americans and introduce affordable electric vehicles. Okay, enough said about that. I want to move on from that. All right, you've heard about all the stuff that happened in 2011. Well, if you haven't heard about it, you're by the time midnight rolls around tonight, you're going to hear about it all. Who died, who lived, what passed. You know all that. Well, I want to talk about the great stuff that's going to happen in 2012. On January 4th, after the moon sets around 3 a.m., the Quadrantid meteor shower reaches its peak in the pre-dawn hours for eastern North America. That would be the eastern seaboard. The Quadrantid meteor shower is a very short-lived meteor display whose peak rates only last several hours. The phase of the moon is a bright waxing gibbous, normally prohibitive for viewing any meteor shower, but the moon will set by 3 a.m., leaving the sky dark for a few hours until the first light of dawn. That's when you'll have the best shot at seeing many of these very cool, bluish-hued meteors. From the eastern half of North America, a single observer might count on seeing as many as 50 to 100 in a single hour. From the western half of the continent, the display will be on the wane by the time the moon sets, with hourly rates probably diminishing to around 25 to 50 meteors. But they're neat because these quadrantids are blue when they burn up in the atmosphere. It's a very cool date for you. Sometimes sky watchers who want to impress your best friends. Now, May 5th, we'll have the biggest moon of 2012. The moon turns full at 11:35 p.m., easy to see, Eastern Daylight Time. Just 25 minutes later, it will arrive at its closest point to the Earth in 2012. At a distance, almost arm's length, 221,801 miles. That's about... that's about 30-something thousand miles closer. Expect a large range in ocean tides, especially low to exceptionally high, for the next few days after this moon approach. On May 20th, you get an annular eclipse of the sun. Now, the path of this annularity for this eclipse starts over eastern China. It sweeps north across southern and central Japan. The path continues northeast, then east, passing just south of Alaska's Aleutian Island chain. Most of that full eclipse will be, or that annular eclipse will be over the ocean. June 4th, we get a partial eclipse of the moon. You'll be able to see it in the Pacific Ocean. Hawaii will see it during the middle of the night. North America will get to see it slightly, Canada. June 5th, rare transit of Venus across the sun. This is a very auspicious passage. It happened in 1639, 1761, 1769. Then it skipped over 100 years and happened in 1874 and 1882. And most recently, it happened in 2004. The next one will occur in the year 2114. So mark it on your calendar, June 5th. Put it in your iPhone. When Venus is in transit across the solar disk, the planet appears as a distinct, albeit tiny, round black spot with a diameter about 1/32 of the sun. The size is large enough to readily perceive, be perceived with the naked eye. However, make sure to use something like a pair of binoculars focused on a piece of paper, or use, better yet, use a coronoscope. Oh, if you have a friend with a coronoscope, contact your local observatory. They have one, or you can buy one. They're about $600. But you will never be able to give it up. Once you look at the sun through a coronoscope, it's like unbelievable animated body out there. It's just churning with energy. It's amazing to see. All right, August 5th, we have, of course, the famous Perseids meteor shower, considered to be among the best annual displays. This year, of course, or I'm sorry, 2011, it was almost a full moon, so you couldn't see anything. But this year, the moon will be a waning crescent, so you'll be able to see them much, much better. November 13th, a total eclipse of the sun. It's going to cross Australia, across the Northern Territory, just to the east of Darwin, then across the Gulf of Carpentaria, then through northern Queensland, passing over Cairns and Port Douglas before heading out to sea. The rest of the eclipse path, including the point of maximum duration of totality, 4 minutes, 2 seconds, is unfortunately pretty much wasted by falling over the open waters of the Pacific Ocean. So it's going to get black, dark over the Pacific Ocean on November 13th. And then December 13th and 14th, again, we'll have the Geminid meteor showers. These are always entertaining. This year, around 2 a.m. is going to be the most active, with about 120 meteors per hour. So it's like one every 30 seconds. And then December 13th through the 22nd, I want you to join Greg Braden, Mayan Elder, Hunbats Men, Colin Andrew, Robert Balval, who's been on this program a couple of times, Marcy Shimoff, myself, Acharya Murdoch, John Ventre, the Minister of Tourism for the Yucatan, Elisa Flores, archaeologist and director of the Chichen Itza Antiquities, Dr. Martha Cuevas, an archaeologist and one of the world's experts on Palenque. You're going to join us December 13th through the 22nd at Maya 2012. In order to do that, all you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the orange banner on the right-hand side. Oh, you think you have 12 months to get ready. You don't. You don't. You need to take your income refund, your tax refund this year, go ahead and take a portion of it, and get yourself registered. Don't let it pass. You need to get the bulk of your payment in now, early in the year. Everything is covered once you get to Houston. Airfare from Houston to Chichen Itza and back to Houston is all covered. Your hotel's covered. You're in good shape. Get to that website by clicking on the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com and get yourself in there. It's 9 days, 10 days overall, and it will be the time of your life. If you've never been to Mexico, make sure you get your passport. No, you don't have to get any of those weird shots. You don't have to worry about that. This is not like going to the jungle or someplace like that. And yes, you can drink the water, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be a great time, and it's going to change your life. And you're going to be able to bring those changes back with you and talk about them for the rest of your life. You're going to take pictures and movies that your kids will watch and your grandkids will watch. And bring your kids. Bring your kids. I would say if they're 15 years or older, bring them. This is ground zero for this year. For 2012, there's no other place that you want to be. I think it's even better than Stonehenge. Been there, done that. Chichen Itza is amazing. And with these speakers at that place, I promise you, the energy is going to be planet-changing. There are other leading transformational speakers and international authors. Your once in many thousands of years chance to gather at the high center of Mayan knowledge for the end of the Mayan calendar and the birth of the great cycle of transformation and renewal is upon you. All you have to do is get there. See yourself there. I do. Also, this in the news, as if we didn't already know, flying is safer than ever. The past 10 years have been the best in the country's aviation history with only 153 fatalities. That's it. 10 years. That's two deaths for every 100 million passengers on commercial flights, according to an Associated Press analysis of government accident data. Now, sitting in a pressurized aluminum tube 7 miles above the ground may never seem like the most natural thing, but consider this. You are more likely to die driving to the airport than flying across the country. There are more than 30,000 motor vehicle deaths each year, a mortality rate 8 times greater than that in planes. By the way, that number, and this is the reason I brought this article up, because they compared it to driving a car or riding in a car, being a passenger in a car, being involved in a car on the road. The reason I brought that up is that number has never changed since automobiles have been on American highways. That's true. Although the DOT has allegedly been making cars safer each year with regulations, the same number of people die each year from traffic accidents today as died before the airbag was invented, and even before the seatbelt was made mandatory in all cars. The only thing that has changed is the price. It now costs more than the average home cost in 1976 to buy a car. The average cost to own and operate an automobile in the United States has gone from about $80 a month to more than $660 a month. That's right. Car payments average $250 a month, some a lot more than that. Full coverage insurance averages $110 a month, some more than that, depends on if you live in New York or Boston or L.A. Gas costs average $250 a month, some more than that, especially if you have a long commute. And maintenance averages $50 a month. If you drive a luxury car, you can raise that to $1,000 a month. The reason that modern technology cannot come to market is because the government regulations prevent it. So, the specter of 1932, how a loss of faith in politicians and democracy could make 2012 the most frightening year in living memory. Do you believe that? I think maybe you won't believe it by the time I finish this piece. But if you have thoughts on it, our number is 888-429-5471. If you're listening live between 8 and 11 on Sunday nights. If you're listening by archive, send me an email on it. I answer every single email. Every one of the thousands of people that have written me over the years will tell you. I write them a personal email, and I will answer your questions. The dawn of a new year is usually a time of hope and ambition, of dreams for the future and thoughts of a better life. But that is a long time since many of us looked forward to the new year with such anxiety, even dread. Now, this article comes from Britain. Many economists believe that by the end of 2012, we could well have slipped into a second devastating recession. I don't think we ever cleared the first one, folks. The coalition remains delicately poised. It would take only one or two resignations to provide a wider schism and a general election. But the real dangers lie overseas, in the Middle East. The excitement of the Arab Spring has long since curdled into sectarian tension and fears of Islamic fundamentalism. And with so many of the world's oil supplies concentrated in the Persian Gulf, British families and American families will be keeping an anxious eye on the events in the Arab world. Meanwhile, as the Eurozone slides toward disaster, the prospects for Europe have rarely been bleaker. Already, the European elite have installed compliant technocratic governments in Greece and Italy, and with the markets now putting pressure on France, few observers can be optimistic that the continent can avoid a total meltdown. As commentators often remark, the world picture has not been grimmer since the dark days of the mid-70s when OPEC shocked the world, causing the rise of stagflation and the surge of nationalist terrorism, casting a heavy shadow over the Western world. For the most chilling parallel, though, we should look back exactly 80 years to the cold, wintry days when 1931 gave way to 1932. The ultimate warning from history. If our political leaders fail to provide adequate direction, the results, as demonstrated 80 years ago, could be catastrophic. Then, as now, few people saw much to mourn in the passing of the old year. It was in 1931 that the Great Depression really took hold in Europe, 2 years after in the United States, bringing governments to their knees and plunging tens of millions of people out of work. Then, as now, the crisis had taken years to gather momentum. After the Wall Street crash in 1929, just after the banking crisis of 2008, some observers even thought that the worst was over. But the summer of 1931, a wave of banking panics swept across Europe as the German and Austrian financial houses tottered. Britain's Labour government came under fierce market pressure to slash spending and cut benefits. Bitterly divided, the Labour leader, Ramsay MacDonald, decided to resign from office, only to return immediately as the leader of an all-party coalition known as the National Government, dominated by Stanley Baldwin's Conservatives. Like today's coalition, the National Government was an uneasy marriage, sunk in self-pity and spending much of its time flirting with aristocratic hostesses. MacDonald cut a miserable and semi-detached figure. By comparison, even Nick Clegg looks like a model of a strong, decisive leadership. As for the Tory leader Stanley Baldwin, he had more in common with David Cameron than we might think. A laid-back, old, Harrovian, tolerant, liberal-minded, and ostentatiously relaxed, Baldwin spent as much time as possible on holiday in the south of France, preferring to enjoy the Mediterranean sunshine rather than get his hands dirty with the nuts and bolts of policy. Sound familiar? Meanwhile, far from offering a strong and coherent opposition, the rump Labour Party seemed doomed to irrelevance. At least its leader, the pacifist Arthur Henderson, could claim to be a man of the people, having hauled himself up by his bootstraps from his early days as a Newcastle metal worker. Not even his greatest admirers could possibly say the same. With the politicians apparently impotent in the face of the economic blizzard, many people were losing faith in parliamentary democracy. Their despair was hardly surprising in some industrial towns of the North, Wales, and Scotland. Unemployment in 1932 reached a staggering 70%. With thousands more being plunged out of work every week, even the national government estimated that 1 in 4 people were making do on a mere subsistence diet. Scurvy, rickets, and tuberculosis were rife in the slag heaps of Wigan. George Orwell saw several hundred women scrabbling in the mud for hours, searching for tiny chips of coal so they could heat their homes. feeling betrayed by mainstream politicians, many sought more extreme alternatives. Then, as now, Britain was rocked by marches and demonstrations. In October 1932, a national hunger march in Hyde Park saw bloody clashes between protesters and mounted policemen, with 75 people being badly injured. Sound familiar? Occupiers? Toothless Ed Miliband can hardly claim to be a man of the people like the pacifist Arthur Henderson. And while left-wing intellectuals were drawn to the supposedly utopian promise of the Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, who turned out to be a brutal tyrant, thousands of ordinary people flocked to the banners of the British Union of Fascists, founded in the autumn of 1932 by the former Labour maverick, Sir Oswald Mosley. 80 years ago, the world was struggling to come to terms with an entirely new financial landscape. In August 1931, the system by which currencies were pegged to the value of gold had fallen apart, with market pressure forcing Britain to pull the pound off the gold standard. Sound familiar? Almost overnight, the system that was supposed to ensure global economic stability was gone, and an international effort to coordinate a response collapsed. So nations across the world fell back on self-interested economic protectionism. In August 1932, the British colonies and dominions met in the Canadian capital, Ottawa, and agreed a policy of imperial preference, putting high tariffs on goods from outside the empire. International free trade was now a thing of the past in this frightening new world. It was every man for himself. Today's situation, of course, is even more frightening. Our equivalent of the gold standard, the misguided folly of the euro, is poised on the brink of disaster. Yet the European elite refused to let poorer Mediterranean nations like Greece and Portugal leave the eurozone, devalue their new currencies, and start again. Should the eurozone collapse, as seems perfectly likely given Greece's soaring debt, Spain's record unemployment, Italy's non-existent growth, and the growing market pressure on France's ailing economy, then the consequences could be much worse than when Britain left the gold standard. The shock waves across Europe, which could come as early as next spring, would see banks tottering, businesses crashing, and millions thrown out of work. For British firms that trade with Europe, as well as holiday companies, airports, travel firms, and the City of London itself, the meltdown of the eurozone could be a catastrophe. And as the experience of 80 years ago suggests, the political and social ramifications would be too terrible to contemplate. Indeed, future historians may well look back and see the first years of the 2010s as the moment when the Chinese Empire began to strengthen its global grip. In the Soviet Union in 1932, meanwhile, Stalin's reign of terror was intensifying, with dissent crushed by the all-powerful Communist Party. Sound familiar? Barack Obama cuts a similar impotent, indecisive, and isolationist figure. The difference is that in 1932, one of the greatest statesmen of the century, the Democratic politician Franklin D. Roosevelt, was waiting in the wings. And yet, we should not forget that Putin himself described the fall of the Soviet Empire as one of the greatest catastrophes of the century, and that half of all Russian teenagers recently told a survey that Stalin was a wise and strong leader. By comparison, Europe's democratic leaders look woolly and vacillating, just as they did back in 1932. Indeed, for the democratic West, this was a truly terrible year. 80 years on, we have no room for complacency. Although the far right remains no more than a thuggish and eccentric minority, The elected prime ministers of Greece and Italy have already been booted out to make way for EU-approved technocrats for whom nobody has ever voted. In the new Europe, the will of the people seems to play second fiddle to the demands of Paris and Berlin. And if the Eurozone crisis intensifies, then it is no idle fantasy to imagine that Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, and their Brussels allies will demand an even greater centralization of powers, provoking nationalist outrage on the streets of Europe's capitals. Today, Barack Obama is that figure that people are looking at and not seeing the kind of security that they need to see. Above all, though, the eyes of the world back in 1932 were fixed on Germany as the Weimar Republic staggered toward oblivion. An obscure Austrian painter was setting his sights on supreme power. With rising unemployment eating away at the bonds of democratic civility, the National Socialist Party was within touching distance of government. It is a prime, fertile ground for a radical and charismatic government to come to power. Today, on the brink of a new year, that could well prove the most frightening and living memory. We can only pray that our history takes a very different path. Are you scared? I don't think so. This is not the environment when one charismatic leader can rise to power. This is a time when the people will take back their planet. The energy is right. If we're careful, if we don't let it rise to the point of fanaticism, if we don't let it go blind, rushing off, smashing windows, burning cars, forcing law enforcement to come to power, to curb it, to take it down, to imprison it, to isolate it, to forbid it, to outlaw it, if we're careful with this energy, if we use the Constitution the way it was designed, it is the oldest and most stable constitution in the world. If we show the rest of the race on the planet what we can do using our law, using our constitution, using our right to vote, if we make the change ourselves in the republic, it can work. We can pull it out. We know what the problem is. You know what the problem is. All the money, all the capital is concentrated in a very few hands, and it's not moving. Now, do I mean we go out and write checks to everybody out in the streets? No. That would do nothing. That would do absolutely nothing to solve the problem, because it would rob you of your dignity. You didn't earn it. You don't deserve it. But if you provide a way for people to earn it, you provide a way for people to hire people, you provide a way for them to buy the inventory it takes to fill orders, you get small business working again. Leave the major corporations alone. They may go bankrupt. So what? They're not the job creators anyway. It's small business that are the job creators. Every major city in this country is having employment problems. Some states are 8%, some states are 12 to 14%. We cannot let it get to 70%, and it will. It will if we let government do what it wants to do. Because government right now is bought and paid for. You know it, I know it. So we can take it back, we can make a change. We can speak, and we can vote, and we can resist the propaganda machines, and we can choose for ourselves. But we must choose wisely, not wildly. We must choose rationally, not radically. We must not practice isolationism. If we cut off the rest of the world from buying their products, we'll plunge the world back into the same mire that we were in the 1930s and 1940s. We must work as a planet, and there is a way to do it. It is going to take a higher consciousness. It is going to take a higher purpose. And we have to work together as a planet, or we're not going to survive. 2012 is the precipice. 2012 was predicted. It is the end of the age. Even Jesus spoke of it. It is time for us to take responsibility for our own life condition, to dream of a family, of a community, of a state, of a nation, and a planet that is far away from the fields of Armageddon. And we can do it. We're out of time. Seems like 3 hours go so fast on this program. It's January 1st, 2012. Next week, we'll see you. It's will be January 8th. And we'll kick off the new year in a big way. Don't forget, Maya 2012. We'll be back. See you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorer. Oops. Here we go. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.